time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern is a 27-year veteran with the CIA, serving as an analyst from 1963 to 1990. He was Robert Gates' branch chief in the early 1970s. From 1981 to 1985, he was an intelligence briefer for President Reagan, where he was in charge of preparing daily security briefs for the president, vice president, the joint chiefs of staff, the national security advisor, and the cabinet. And finally, he was one of several senior CIA analysts who prepared the president's daily brief during the first Bush administration. He is co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and co-director of the Servant Leadership School in Washington, D.C. Ray, thank you very much for coming in and spending time again with us this morning.
Glad to be with you, Mike.
Well, last time we talked to you, it was in March of this year, and the Obama administration was pretty much brand spanking new at that point. You gave us your analysis of how you saw things then with the administration. I want to get your feedback on what you think of the Obama administration now, especially in light of their spending at least the last month analyzing the situation in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have the utmost respect for Obama facing down the pressures not to dither. I mean, if George Bush and Dick Cheney had dithered a little, that is, if they had thought through what they were doing in Iraq, we wouldn't be in the mess that we are now, what they were doing in Iraq and what they were not doing in Afghanistan. So dithering is exactly the wrong word. What they're doing is assessing the policy from the bottom up and trying to figure out, you know, what this is all about, whether it's really necessary, given the fact that there are, according to National Security Advisor James Jones, there are between 10 and 100 Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Okay? So we need 40,000 more troops to catch them or not let them back in from Pakistan. You know, it doesn't parse. It just doesn't make any sense. So what's happening here is what the Germans call a Denkpause, okay, a pause to think, okay? That is, against the pressures that he's facing, that is commendable. And I suppose the decision will come pretty quickly, and on that decision will hinge the rest of his presidency, I am convinced. Because if he bows to what the military wants, I was an Army officer, and I know how it is. If you're in the Army, you're a hammer, and everything looks like a nail, okay? Everything looks like a battle or a war to be fought. So when Obama asks, or anybody asks the military for a solution, can you do it? The answer is instinctively, yes, sir, you know? All we need is 40,000, or maybe 80,000, or maybe 500,000, which is what it would take to pacify some parts of Afghanistan. And even then, just as in Vietnam, we would not prevail. So he's getting good advice from others now. Jonathan Schell has an incredible article in The Nation today. So there's a real crucible here. And if Obama sticks to his guns, if he is touched by having visited those transfer cases, you know what I'm talking about? In Dover, Delaware, what arrived now are not coffins, not remains. They're transfer cases. That's what the Washington Post calls them. Now, he went out to meet those remains, visited with the families, was visibly moved, I thought. I watched it live. And, if he is a mensch, like I think he is, and he also has very good sense, like I think he has, he's going to face this stuff down. And I have to say I'm in the minority of my colleagues who believing the cup to be half full, but I do believe it to be half full, and I think he needs the kind of support from us, from people who know what Vietnam was like, people with a touch of gray in their hair, okay? If you're under 45, you don't know anything about Vietnam, okay? And, you know, there are certain advantages to being old, and that's one of them. Been there, done that. So I think he's seeking counsel from people who have been there, done that now, and I'm hopeful that this will save his administration and allow him not to get involved like LBJ did, which endangered and really put the coffin nail in the Great Society program. Obama's got lots else to deal with, healthcare, the economy, even global warming. He can't afford to put billions and billions more dollars in Afghanistan and suffer thousands and thousands more U.S. killed, not to mention Afghanis. And, you know, last time I checked the Bible, Afghans are also human beings that shouldn't be killed.
There are a lot of critics on the left that believe he is moving far too slowly, and pretty much, you know, just peddling in following what the Pentagon wants him to do. What's your take on that?
Well, we'll know just a couple weeks. You know, we'll know who's right. That's a legitimate piece of anxiety, of impatience. You know, I can understand that because people are being killed. But, you know, it's a judicious pause for thinking. It's not what LBJ did, you know. It's not what George Bush and Dick Cheney did. So I applaud him for that, and I just hope he comes to the right decision. You know, Jonathan Schell, I dug out a little piece from him this morning, and he puts it in really good perspective. He says, like the imperial powers of the past, the United States wants to impose its will on other countries, in this case, Afghanistan. Yet it's different. He said it is different from the previous powers because it does not aim to rule these countries indefinitely, okay? We can't occupy Afghanistan indefinitely. So, conscious that the American public won't support a war, we want to leave someday. So the art of victory has to be to try to set up a government that A, can survive our withdrawal, and B, can serve our interests. The circle to be squared, says Jonathan Schell, is getting the people of a whole country to want what Washington wants. The trouble is that left to their own devices, other peoples are likely to want what they want and not what we want. Hello? You know, there it is, right there. Now, the other thing that I quote here is he says, the main problem is the missing government. Okay? He said, this is not a detail of policy. This is fatal to the whole enterprise. There's a missing government in Afghanistan, and what government that is totally corrupt. Witness the fact that one out of every three votes for Karzai in the last election was, you know, written in like we used to do in the Bronx. You know, it just doesn't work. If you don't have the popular support, you can't prevail in a counterinsurgency position. So I think Obama's being told that, training up the army. Give me a break. There is no Afghan army. At least in Vietnam, there was some semblance of an army. I remember this really distinctly. It comes from the tape, The Fog of War. Okay, McNamara. McNamara's got the speech done on defense posture. He sends it to LBJ. He says, like your comments, going to give it next Wednesday. And LBJ calls him on the phone. You can hear it. He says, "Hey, Mac, I read your speech, but I really think you ought to say something about Vietnam." McNamara says, "Well, sir, I thought of that, of course, but sir, I don't know what to say." Mac, we're defending their freedom. We're training up their army, and the training's going real good. That's what you say, Mac. That's one hell of a way to make policy, okay? And what did Mac do? He said, "We're training them up, and the training's going good, and it wasn't going good, and you can't train a native army to do what the Americans want them to do, because they all have their cousins, and they're all infiltrating the army, and they're not going to kill their cousins. And when we leave, it'll be the same as in Vietnam. So we leave as soon as we can." Now, people, I think, legitimately say, "Well, McGovern, okay, so you're going to leave, and there's going to be chaos, there's going to be bloodshed, and you don't feel any responsibility for outlining a detailed little plan for how you leave, so you don't have this kind of thing." And I say, great powers can make big decisions, and then they can influence the effects of those decisions. And I refer back to Vietnam. George Kennan, my idol as the major Soviet Russian specialist, ambassador of the Soviet Union, author of the containment policy, in 1966, you know, when only 8,000 had been killed so far, U.S., he said, "We have to get out of Vietnam. It just makes no sense. We will not prevail. It's just a feckless exercise." And here, you know, callow youth that I was, 2 years with the Central Intelligence Agency at the time, and I'm saying, wow, Well, that's irresponsible. George Kennan, my idol? Clay Feet. How can he... Hasn't he heard about the dominoes? You know? Doesn't he know what's going to happen? So, you know, I'm sort of buying into all the rhetoric, all the, you know, excuses used to keep us in there. And it took me another year to realize, hey, you know, you don't have to spell out exactly what happens. All you have to do is take a considered decision to do the right thing, and then you figure out how to influence. And what we need to do is work together with all the neighbors there, including Iran, including China, including the Soviet Union, including the Arab states, and we get together and we figure it out. We go to Geneva and we figure it out, and we talk with the Taliban and we work it out. If there are only 100 or even less Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, it should be possible for us to figure it out. We need to get the Pakistanis in there, but it can be done. What we need to do is take the major decision, which George Kennan, of course, saw in 1966. And, of course, after that, 50,000 the U.S. troops were killed because the thing went on to 73, 75. So the major decision needs to be taken now. We can work out the details because we are a great power, because we are the sole remaining superpower in the world. We still have a lot of influence, and so we can influence for the best. Will there be no bloodshed? Of course there'll be lots of bloodshed. Just as in Iraq, when we finally leave Iraq. All the surge did, and this is important, all the surge did was postpone by about 3 years what is inevitable. Bush and Cheney didn't want to lose a war in their watch. It was clear that they were going to unless they surged. 30,000 U.S. troops? Yeah, that's enough to do it. What you do is you ethnically cleanse Baghdad. You get all the Sunni. Baghdad used to be a predominantly Sunni capital. What they did was form a screen where the Shia could ethnically cleanse the Sunni out of Baghdad, and sure, the violence went down. We paid off people at Anbar, and we persuaded some of the radical clerics to go to Iran. Okay, it was tamped down, and Bush and Cheney rode off into the sunset without having lost the war. Well, who's going to take the blame for losing the war now? When U.S. troops withdraw, there is going to be chaos. And the same chaos that would have been 3 years ago. Who's going to take the blame? Of course, Obama will. So these things need to be faced into. They need to be faced into realistically. The military needs to be consulted. But you don't just, you know, Bush and Cheney used to always say, well, we're relying on the judgment of the military on the ground. Well, you know, that was only half true. You know, people don't realize. At the end of 06, General Casey, field commander in Iraq, and General Abi Zaid, the head of CENTCOM, went to the Senate Armed Services Committee and said, please, this is September 06, okay? He said, please, no more troops, okay? Please don't send us any more troops. Because if you send us more troops, the Iraqis are never going to get it through their head that they have to put their own house in order. They have to sort of find ways to accommodate one another, okay? They'll just keep ducking that problem. And so what does Bush do? Well, he goes to his American Enterprise Institute folks, and he says, well, what happens if we don't put any more troops in there? And they say, well, it's simple, Mr. President. You lose a war on your watch. So he says, well, how can I avoid that? 30,000 should do it, you know, should put it off for a couple of years. That's the surge, folks. That's the surge. Nothing more nor less than that. So we put in 30,000 folks, and we tamped down the situation in Baghdad. We caused 2.5 million refugees inside Iraq, in addition to the 2 million already in diaspora outside of in the neighboring countries of Iraq. You know, that's out of a population of about 24 million. Give me a break. Is that what the United States is all about? Well, that's what's happened. So what we're looking forward to, you know, in a sense, in Iraq and Afghanistan are volatile situations which we can influence, but in a measured way, and sending more troops is exactly the wrong prescription.
One of the questions one sees more and more often in, for instance, letters to the editor online, as well as hearing from the troops that one does hear from serving in Afghanistan, is why are we there?
Ah, thanks, Mike. Nobody ever asked us that question. Well, let me talk about Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq, There was a fellow who was CEO of Halliburton. I forget his name now. He became vice president. Dick Cheney's his name. And he made a big speech in 1998, and he said, look, people accuse us of being, of not being alert to the fact that we need more oil. They don't realize that the prize lies, those were his words, the prize lies in the Middle East, and most of that oil is controlled by governments that are unfriendly. So what do they want us to do, you know? Well, 2 years later, Dick Cheney comes into office as vice president, convenes this energy task force, and they figure out what to do. What to do is take advantage of this ruthless dictator in Baghdad, the fact that he's got no army, and the fact that, he's easily attacked, and so they attack him with the hope that they can control the oil resources in Iraq. Now, anybody could have told them that they're not going to be able to do that, and they're not going to be able to do that. Those oil resources will be portioned out to lots of countries besides the United States. Now, how about Afghanistan? Well, we know that in 1999, the fellow who headed Enron, I think it was Ken Lay is his name, he wrote a nice little letter, which we have a copy of, to the governor of Texas. His name was George W. Bush. And he said, the Afghan ambassador is going to come and see you, and we've got a really interesting project going, a pipeline coming down from Turkmenistan down into the Indian Ocean. We'll go through Afghanistan. It has to go through those mountains. But we got a route all, and the Taliban's going to come and talk to you, and we want you to listen to this very carefully because it's a really important project. There's going to be a lot of good money made on this, and we'll have a strategic position there because, well, he didn't say this in the letter, but I've learned subsequently that the natural gas in Turkmenistan, just to the north of Afghanistan, is worth more in dollars than all the oil under the sands of Iraq. Can you believe it? So that's what was planned, okay? This oil and gas pipeline will come down into the Indian Ocean. Now, I had a chance to ask the urbane and witty Zalmay Khalilzad, who is a big oil man, but was also our ambassador in Afghanistan and Iraq, at a meeting of RAND 2 weeks ago. I said, now, what about natural resources? What about the notion this might be a resource war? You know, like Iraq was the first resource war of the 21st century. Is Afghanistan the second? And he gulped and he said, well, I think that you can't be thinking about a pipeline through Afghanistan in the chaotic conditions that exist now. It needs to be tamped down. There needs to be some minimal security before that pipeline can go through. I'm thinking, well, does that mean that's why we have to make minimal security? I didn't get a chance to ask a follow-up, but there it was. You know, here's the guy who knows. So he was involved in these negotiations with the Taliban. So this is a major factor that is never mentioned. Nobody wants to think that we're in it for the natural resources. But, you know, subconsciously, I think a lot of Americans realize, you know, when Bush or Cheney used to say, they're after our way of life. Okay. What does that mean? Does that mean $4 a gallon? $5 a gallon? You know? I think subconsciously, or maybe some people let me tell you about one person here who consciously told me what he really thought. This was in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, right outside of Milwaukee. It's sort of like, the real real rich suburb of Milwaukee, okay? I'm giving a lecture there. I finish in about an hour, and I said I'd take more questions in the back because we had to stop. So there are about 30 people congregated around me. And this one very well-dressed, middle-aged fellow comes up and he says, Mr. McGovern, what's your problem? I don't understand what your problem is. And I said, I beg your pardon? He said, well, you don't deny the fact that we need the oil, do you? I said, of course not. I mentioned oil. He says, well, then you have to admit that 3 or 4 U.S. troops killed every week is a very small price to pay for the oil that we need. Now, I had not heard anybody say it quite like that before. And he went on, he said, in Vietnam we lost hundreds in a week. So, what's your problem? And I looked around, and I was hoping, you know, for kind of shocked looks, but nobody was shocked. Everybody's looking at me, what's McGovern going to say? So I think, you know, the utilitarian argument is going to work with this guy. I said, they're not going to let us get their oil, you know. We can try to, they're not going to let us, okay? I said, oh, Mr. McGovern, we're the sole remaining superpower in the world. Give me a break. We can do what we want. We'll get their oil. So then I thought, well, I got angry. I said, you know, well, suppose one of those GIs killed last week was your son. He said, it wouldn't be my son. And that's the problem. That's the problem. It wouldn't be his son, okay? Then I got mad, and I said, well, you know, are you one of those who would like to have the Ten Commandments introduced in the courthouses and the, you know, the schools? And this, oh, yeah, that would be a good idea. I said, well, I don't remember very, very distinctly, but I think there's one that says, thou shalt not covet, yeah, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's oil, not oil, but goods. And another one says, thou shalt not steal. There's the one that says, thou shalt not kill. Another one says you shouldn't lie about what your objectives are. And there's even one, I think it's the first or the second one, that says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, as if God would support the kind of war that you're justifying because we need oil. And so maybe you ought to subtract those five. You ended up put five commandments in the school. Well, he got really, really angry, turned around, rushed out to his SUV, gunned it all up, and peeled out of there, you know, using lots of oil just to peel out real quick. And I said to myself, wow, you know, there's a lesson to be learned there, because not only he, but all those, you know, the 29 others who were gathered around there didn't think that his question was beyond the pale. They were wondering how I would explain, how I would argue with the notion that, you know, four or five GIs killed in a given week was not worth, you know, the oil, the objective for oil. So natural resources are a major factor. The last thing I'll say on this subject, and it's something that I learned from my grandchildren. I learned lots from my grandchildren. This is from little Ronan, who was four at the time. I was helping in his nursery school, okay? And it was really neat, these little kids. So after it was all over, I went up to the teacher. I said, what do you try to teach four-year-olds? And she said, that's easy. We teach them that you need to share. And I said, Cheney and Bush never went to nursery school, at least not this nursery school. I mean, there's a finite amount of oil and natural gas in this world. And I believe that Iraq can be legitimately regarded as the first resource war of the 21st century. And unless we get together with the Chinese, with the Indians, with the other countries that are very powerful in that area and say, look, we have to work out some sort of sensible arrangement. We have to learn how to share. There's going to be more and more wars, including the Afghanistan war. So, you know, hello, pretty basic, you know. We can't go in trying to control. We can't do it. We saw what happened in Iraq. What we need to do is to go in and say, all right, let's work this out. And you don't have a belligerent Soviet Union anymore. You have a Russia that's willing to work such things like that out. And you have a China that's going to be a terrible threat to us unless we can work out amicable solutions to these kinds of problems. You have Indians that are putting millions of cars on the road every year. You know, you got to work this stuff out. And the way to do it is to negotiate. And, you know, it should be possible to do that.
We have about 5 minutes left. Speaking of negotiation, last time you were here, you also talked about that you were hopeful, you're the glass is always half full guy, that George Mitchell had been appointed to help mend things between Israel and the Palestinians. Have you been following anything that's been going on there? What's your thoughts on that?
I have, it is a terribly disappointing situation. I was enthused by the president's speech in Cairo, where he admitted, among other things, that we had overthrown the duly elected government in Iran. Big. That's big. Why do we do that? Well, when Mossadegh came in 1953, he had this bizarre notion that the oil underneath the sands of Iran belonged to the Iranians. Can you imagine that? Yeah. He didn't realize it belonged to British Petroleum, right? The British Petroleum recruited this young CIA, you know, like couple of years old, and so they overthrew the government. So anyhow, he admitted to that, and I thought he was really reaching out, trying to settle things. Now, George Mitchell is no slouch. I mean, if he can bring the bigoted Irish, of which I'm one, you know, together and work out things in Northern Ireland, that's a terrific accomplishment. But he's out of his league now. I mean, Henry Clay himself, I mean, great conciliators would be powerless as long as we give the Israelis $3 billion a year. As long as we defend the war crimes in Gaza. I have friends just back from Gaza. It's a terrible, terrible thing that we're condoning. Not only condoning, but supporting and actually preventing the Goldstone report from being considered seriously. So, you know, it is our own policy. It is the strength of the AIPAC, and what I call the Likud lobby in our Congress, that prevents us from having a cogent policy toward the Middle East. You know, people say the Israeli influence is so great in our government. Well, you know, they all saw that that we offered to make Israel the 51st state. Have you heard that, Mike? Yeah. And they turned it down. And we said, well, why would you turn it down? He said, well, then we'd only have two senators. You know, I mean, I make a joke out of it. But when you look at that vote, you look at that vote in the House just 2 weeks ago, which said, look, Goldstone is anti-Semitic because he accuses Israel of war crimes, and so please don't pay any heed to him, Mr. President. That lopsided vote shows that the power of the Israel lobby in our country is so great that we can't really pursue sensible policies in that area. That is a great shame, because you know, one of the things we're going to see in the coming weeks is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, okay? He's going to be tried, okay? He's going to be asked why he did it. If he was the mastermind behind 9/11, why did he do it? Well, he already told. He already told his interrogators. And what did he say? He said this, just at a time when the 9/11 report was being brought to a conclusion. He said, he told the interrogators who knew that he studied in North Carolina, at North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, the young people writing reports said, oh, he must have had a real bad love affair or something. He must have been, you know, really, really ticked off by his experience at North Carolina A&T. Well, the 9/11 report, look at page 147, and it says, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's animus toward the United States was not due to his experience in North Carolina at college. Rather, he attributed directly to lopsided U.S. support for the State of Israel. Okay, that's a direct quote. Now, hello, has anybody seen that in what I call the fawning corporate media? Now, I'm not saying that's his only motive, but that's what he told his interrogators. Why would he lie when he's, you know, been waterboarded 183 times? He was the guy, you know? So, now, you know, the crowning, well, I won't go on, but the media now is saying that, no, he was motivated by being put in jail because he bounced a check in Greensboro, North Carolina. Yeah, you can't change the story like that. But when you talk about the effects of Israeli policy, you know, the bombing and the strafing and the helicopter gum chips and what they're doing in Gaza, 1.3 billion Muslims look on that on their TV sets every night. And if you're looking for why there are suicide bombers, why there are people willing to do that kind of thing, it's because they have no hope.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time again with us.
It's my pleasure, Mike. Good to be with you again.